I invite you to please rise as your spirits and bodies allow and join us in our hymn sing. We'll be starting with Enter, Rejoice, and Come In. Sing it with energy.
Not enter, rejoice, but
enter, rejoice. Let's do it. Something a little bit different. We'll listen to it once and then we'll sing it. Yeah, you can be seated for this one. And we'll sing this through a few times, so just go with it.
Open my heart to all that I seek. Let me be part of the love you give.
Softly.
Open my heart to all that I seek. Let me be part of the love.
How many folks know Emma's Revolution? Know the song Peace, Salam, Shalom? No? Okay, so I'm going to sing it and then you repeat after me, okay?
Peace, Salam, Shalom. 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 Peace, salam, shalom.
Peace, salam, shalom. Please rise. Peace, salam, shalom. 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 Keep going. Keep going. Sing from your belly.
Peace, shalom, shalom.
In New York.
Peace, shalom, shalom.
In Baghdad.
Peace, shalom, shalom.
In Chicago.
Peace, shalom, shalom.
In Alton. Peace, shalom, shalom. Peace, shalom, shalom. Peace, shalom, shalom. Salam shalom. Keep going. Peace, salam shalom. In Ferguson.
Peace, shalom, shalom.
In Paris.
Peace, shalom, shalom.
In Australia.
Peace, shalom, shalom.
The world over. Peace, salam shalom. Peace, salam shalom. Peace, salam shalom. Salam shalom. Beautiful. Please be seated.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the First Unitarian Church of Alton. My name is Mary Johnson. This church is a unique place. In the words of Reverend Chris Shiner, every Unitarian Universalist has the right to develop a personal philosophy of life without being told what to believe. We can learn from all philosophies and religions, and also from the science and the arts. We explore life issues in a caring community, united by shared values rather than shared theological opinions. And no matter what we do believe about theology or philosophy, we try to live a good life and leave the world better than we found it. I offer my welcome to you, and in particular to those who are first-time visitors. We welcome you and especially encourage you to join us after worship for coffee and conversation. Information about the church is available in the fellowship hall, during coffee hour, and from any of those gathered. We invite you to fill out one of the visitor cards found in the back of the gray hymnal and place the card in the offering plate or give it to an usher. And we'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about the activities and programs going on here at church. We are glad you are here and hope to see you again on future Sundays. At the front of the sanctuary on my right, we have the Spirit Chair, which includes activities for all ages, including coloring pages, crayons, pipe cleaners, and more. And you're invited to go there anytime during the service to take an activity back to your seat. We welcome everyone into this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. And our first announcement is a special one given by Ruth Maskow from the Ministerial Search Committee.
Good morning. My name is Ruth Maskow, as she says. I'm a member of the Ministerial Search Committee. The committee would like to encourage you to do two things. One of them is to complete the survey, which as a member you have received either by email or some other means. Of course, if you're not a member, you can always sign the book and we'll give you a survey. This survey offers every member of the congregation the chance to express needs and wishes regarding a future minister, which we are planning on calling. We ask that you complete this survey by September 18th. On another note, the search committee also would like to tell you about the Beyond Categorical Thinking service, Sunday service and worship service and workshop on September 20th. Beyond Categorical Thinking is designed to help all of us examine our own fears and prejudices about racism, sexism, heterosexism, and ableism. Our leader that day, Jerry Carden from Champaign-Urbana, has received training on effective methods to address these fears in himself and in our UU congregations. Leaders such as Mr. Carden are committed to increasing the diversity of our movement. And then there's a special bonus on that day, which is a free lunch, which will be served between the service and the workshop. So we look forward to seeing you then. Thank you.
I have several announcements up here. From Ed. The elementary RE program will be doing readings of Dr. Seuss books this year, starting in September. And if you are willing or passionate to be a reader, please contact Ed. This note is from Lane. She will be meeting after church with those interested in having a discussion about what we should be looking for in a minister. She'll be meeting at the fireplace for the next 3 weeks. So if you're interested in giving some input, please talk with her. Another one, Robin Shanquist, stand up, Robin. She has agreed to chair the grounds committee. So see her after the service if you are interested in helping out. I have a few more announcements. A work crew is needed to repair water damage in several classrooms downstairs. There will be a work day next Saturday afternoon from 1 to 5 to focus on the last room on the left, which is the orange room. It has water damage on one wall due to moisture seeping in from the outside. And there's also water damage on the ceiling due to a leak from upstairs. So next Saturday will be the prep day, scraping, sanding, and using wall sealant. And the following Saturday, September 5th, will be the repainting day. Kelly Crone Willis, building chair, will help direct the work. Outdoor work is also needed, but now we have an outdoor grounds person, to remove ivy and vines from the exterior of the walls and the air conditioning unit, among other places. And there's a sign-up sheet in the worker room for those who want to help with these projects. Mona Hebert invites everyone to stay after services today for birthday cake to celebrate Paul's 65th birthday. And also, Mona wants to thank everyone for their generous donation last spring for the Shoes Into Water program to help provide funds to dig wells in Haiti and several countries in Africa. There was a competition, Battle of the Boot, between several area universities, and St. Louis University, the university she works for, won. There is a new coffee hour committee called the Kitchen Club, and we are taking a proactive stance in getting volunteers to do coffee hour cleanup. No longer will there simply be a sign-up sheet on the desk, although it will be available. But we will be approaching you directly with a schedule on a clipboard and a pencil, asking which dates you would like to do coffee hour cleanup. And in addition, we've developed a list of tasks to help you get everything done in a timely manner. And that approach is going to start today. And I found, when I was cleaning out the desk in the worker room, some old family photos that were probably left from the Day of the Dead back in November. So they're out on the windowsill. Please look at them, and if there's any family resemblance, please take the pictures. Sunshine, do you have announcements?
I think more than a family resemblance, you should probably actually be related to them. I throw that out there. My name is Reverend Sunshine Jeremiah Wolf. I am the interim minister here at the First Unitarian Church of Alton. That means that I am here on a contract. I am not allowed to be called at the end of that contract. It's not even an option. And so I will be here until the end of July, preaching until mid-June, and I'm happy to be with this congregation. It's a great community, and I think you're going to find a wonderful minister at the end of this year. Just a few announcements. One, on September 11th at 7 o'clock p.m., we will be starting our race film series. This will be a monthly series of films. The first month will be the movie Selma. If you have not seen it, it is really excellent, and it actually features the unfortunate story, but important story, of two of the Unitarian Universalists who were involved in the Montgomery movement, both who were killed as a result of being participants in it. In October, the film will be Fruitvale Station, and then we will go from there. So please keep an eye out for those, and we hope to see you on September 11th at 7. On September 9th, I will begin an anti-oppression class. This is for anybody who's interested. It is a general class. We will cover everything from racism and sexism to homophobia and transphobia, xenophobia, talking about Christian hegemony and just the many kinds of oppression that are out there. This will be an 8-session class, an hour and a half each Wednesday, every other Wednesday, until December 15th or 16th. Thank you for that, Lynn. So if you're interested in that, make sure you let me know or you sign up. Or if you're on Facebook, you can join the Facebook event for that. And I do believe that concludes this morning's announcements.
We'll begin our service with a prelude. Worship words this morning are from Sa'id, to serve the people. To worship God is nothing other than to serve the people. It does not need rosaries, prayer, carpets, or robes. All peoples are members of the same body, created from one essence. If fate brings suffering to one member, the others cannot stay at rest.
As Jerry Johnson lights our chalice, I invite you to join me in the hand motions and words of our chalice lighting. It goes like this. We light this chalice. We light this chalice. Symbol of Unitarian Universalism. Symbol of Unitarian Universalism. May it remind us of the divine spark in all of creation. May it remind us of the divine spark in all of creation, the power of love to heal what is broken, and to be grateful for life's blessings each day. May it be so. I invite you to please rise as your spirits and bodies allow. We're going to sing Come, Come, Whoever You Are. This is a song written by one of our Unitarian Universalist ministers after she visited the grave of Jalaluddin Rumi in Konya, Turkey. And we're going to sing it in English and Spanish. I will note that the words do miss one line from it. It goes, come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, though you've broken your vows 1,000 times, come yet again, come. So we're going to sing it in Spanish. For those of you who don't know it, I'll tell you the same thing I told the congregation when we first started in the Spanish. It's more what you sound like and less what you actually say, right? So if you don't have quite the pronunciation, it doesn't matter. Just pretend like it sounds good. Ready? Here we go.
Please join me in reading our congregational Hear Covenant. To strengthen and nurture our welcoming community with love, compassion, and respect, we covenant together to honor and make space for our diversity, respect our volunteers, leaders, and staff by supporting balance in their lives and in their personal and professional pursuits, encourage each member to develop a personal spiritual practice that cultivates honesty and acceptance. Remembering our humanness, we acknowledge our imperfection and extend forgiveness to ourselves and others. Engage with our own and larger community with integrity by taking responsibility for our actions, facilitating right relationships, and living into the journey.
Who knows what Islam is? Yeah? Arthur, what's Islam? It's a religion. That's right. Ron?
Surrender.
It's surrender. Ooh, that's a big one. They're sometimes known as submission. We'll talk more about that later. Who was Muhammad? Peace be upon him. He's a prophet, right? He is the person who heard the words of Allah spoken unto him in a cave. His wife, Khadijah, wrote them down, and then it was shared with the world. Because Muhammad couldn't read or write, but his wife could. Who knows about Khadijah? Have I heard of Khadijah before?
She was a merchant, so that she made quite a bit of money with trading.
Quite a bit of money with trading, and what was that? Moses. What you were going to say, exactly. She's most well known for being a very shrewd businesswoman. When her father died, she was the most invested in the family business, and so she took it over. This is in the 600s, and this is when the communities where Islam was being born was nomadic. And so her main job was running caravans out of Mecca. And Muhammad, who had been just a laborer in her world, but had garnered her respect, became the person who managed the caravan. He made sure that things got there on time. He negotiated the relationships in the cities that they traveled to. And she grew to respect him. And she had been married twice, but both of her husbands had died very quickly. And as she got to know Muhammad and to see his integrity and his honesty and his compassion, she asked him to marry her. And he said yes. And at that time, he was 25 years old and she was 40 years old. What was that, Robin?
I was just saying it's sort of interesting how modern day Islam has sort of forgotten that story.
It has not, actually, but we'll talk about that by the end of the day as well. So, he was 25 years old and she was 40 years old, right? And They ended up, and as opposed to her first husbands who died quickly, they were married together for 25 years before she died. And Khadija was and is considered to be the first follower of Islam. She is beloved in the Muslim community. And in fact, when you see women wearing hijabs, women who are, you know, you would think, okay, this is a person who's educated and who, you know, maybe they wouldn't choose to wear a hijab. They're not wearing the hijab out of some sense of I'm lesser than or, you know, some role of sexism, which is often what's portrayed in our media. Don't believe everything you hear. They wear the hijab in memory. Thank you for saying that. For the hijab in memory of Khadija and also of Mother Mary, also known as Miriam. The hijab is the headwear that people, that women wear in Islam, as opposed to the burqa, which is the full, okay? In both cases, there are women who choose to wear the hijab or the burqa because of remembering these strong women who are a core part of Islam. And so Khadija, who believed in her husband wholeheartedly and knew that he was telling the truth about what he was hearing, wrote down his words and helped in sharing the message. And she shared these words and her, you know, her husband's wisdom to the point where it became a full-fledged religion. It became a religion that allowed these nomadic peoples to find connection, because before they were all arguing back and forth. And as they went into Islam, became Muslims, they stopped warring so much. And a lot of them settled down in the areas that they're in, including Mecca, which is where the house is, the place where people go at least once in their lifetime to pay homage to Allah and to their religion. So that is Khadija. Khadija was a strong woman. She had all the agency in the world. To be fair, there are cultures that have Islam as a primary practice who do not tell that story as much. But the average Muslim on the street, most everywhere in the world, knows Khadija and celebrates her life every year and remembers her at Ramadan and knows the importance of women in their community. Each week we take some time to consider those joys and sorrows, those concerns and difficulties in our lives. And as people of many faiths, many beliefs, many philosophies, we come together in this one ritual to share in those struggles and in those joys that we may have in our lives. You're invited to come forward and place a stone or stones in the bowl to recognize and remember, to bring to your awareness, your mindfulness, your soulfulness, those things which you are carrying in your lives. This is this ritual of joy and sorrow. I invite you to come forward as you are willing and able.
Open my heart to all that I see. Let me be part of the love you give. Open my heart to all that I see. Let me be part of the love you give. Open my heart to all that I seek. Let me be part of the love you give. Open my heart to all that I seek. Let me be part of the love you give.
Everyone as you're able.
Open my heart to all that I seek. Let me be part of the love you give. Open my heart to all that I seek. Let me be part of the love you give.
a stone for those joys and sorrows lying in the silent sanctuaries of our hearts, and a stone for all those who cannot be with us in community today. I invite you now into a time of meditation, prayer, or contemplation, as is your own personal spiritual practice. And I invite you to be present into this space, to be aware of the feeling of the pews and the floor beneath your feet. Be attentive to the sounds around you. To be here now. O Spirit of life, we open ourselves to the wonderment of the world, to the mysteries beyond our experience and our knowledge, and to those things that ground us and help us be present. We offer our blessings and our prayers to all those who are ill, to those who are sick, to those who are dying, and to those in times of grief. May our love enwrap them, engulf them, hold them, and they know that they are not alone. May we know that we are enough to face the trials of our lives, and that it often feels like we're not. May we forgive ourselves for all those things which we struggle with, that we feel guilt or shame for, so that we may receive the forgiveness of others. And may we offer that forgiveness to others when it is asked for. In a time of violence and uncertainty, when young black folks are being killed at a ridiculous rate, at a time when we are in multiple wars throughout the world, when refugees are struggling from Mexico and Latin America to Africa and beyond, may we find in our hearts the presence and patience to support and care, to know that we and they are not alone. And in this day, we offer our celebration and our joy, lifting up our hearts to the gift of children, to infants, to elders with their wisdom, to laughter, to the beauty and power of rain to rejuvenate, and the wonderment of the sun as it fades into winter. We open our spirits in gratitude for all that has been given us, particularly when it is hard to see. I invite you now into a moment of silent contemplation, prayer, or meditation. And as we return into this space, may we know that we are not alone. May we let our troubles lay here in this sacred place, and let our joys be celebrated with and among ourselves and the world. Blessed be.
Come to me.
We receive these gifts gratefully, and we dedicate them to the work of our congregation, welcoming the stranger and upholding religious freedom, honoring human wholeness, and caring for our planet. Together, we seek to serve with ever greater love. This morning's offering will be gratefully received. May it be lovingly given.
I invite you to join me in our offertory blessing. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves and these our offerings.
I have a reading this morning. Umar ibn Akhtab said, "One day, when we were with God's messenger, a man with very white clothing and very black hair came up to us. No mark of travel was visible on him, and none of us recognized him. Sitting down before the prophet, leaning his knees against his and placing his hands on his thighs, he said, 'Tell me, Muhammad, about submission.' He replied, 'Submission means that you should bear witness that there is no God but God, and that Muhammad is God's messenger, that you should perform the ritual prayer, pay the alms tax, fast during Ramadan, and make the pilgrimage to the house if you are able to go there.' The man said, 'You have spoken the truth.' We were surprised at his questioning him and then declaring that he had spoken the truth. He said, 'Now tell me about faith.' He replied, 'Faith means that you have faith in God, his angels, his books, his messengers, and the last day, and that you have faith in the measuring out, both its good and its evil.' Remarking that he had spoken the truth, he then said, 'Now tell me about doing what is beautiful.' He replied, 'Doing what is beautiful means that you should worship God as if you see him, or even if you do not see him, he sees you.' Then the man said, 'Tell me about the hour.' The prophet replied, 'About that, he who is questioned knows no more than the questioner.' The man said, 'Then tell me about its marks.' He said, 'The slave girl will give birth to her mistress, and you will see the barefoot, the naked, the destitute, and the shepherds vying with each other in building.' Then the man went away. After I had waited for a long time, the prophet said to me, 'Do you know who the questioner was, Umar?' I replied, 'God and his messenger know best.' He said, 'He was Gabriel. He came to teach you your religion.'"
Anybody tell me the significance of Gabriel to Muhammad? Anybody know that?
He's an angel in the Old Testament.
He's an angel in the Quran. He is who spoke the words of God to Muhammad, peace be upon him. And you'll notice I say peace be upon him after Muhammad, peace be upon him, because I'm trying to be respectful of a religion that is not mine. And I want to say as I speak today that while I have been well educated by Muslims about Islam, I am not Muslim, and I want to be careful about what I say and how I speak about it today, because there are many stereotypes, many assumptions out there, many of them even within the liberally intellectual communities of which I'm a part. And so I want to do as much respect and awareness as I can today. I learned about Islam while attending Star King School for the Ministry, which is a seminary in Berkeley. Yes? He is. Gabriel is the messenger. Exactly right. So in the seminary where I was attending, Sheikh Yasir Chadli was teaching a class on Rumi and understanding Rumi and Sufism and Islam. And there were 30 of us gathered in the room. We'd been in class for probably about 6 weeks at this point. And after having discussed theology and Rumi's poetry, we prepared for Salat, which is the prayers. And in the evening prayers, Sheikh Yasir asked us to form lines so that our arms were lightly touching one another. He said, it doesn't matter what gender you are. We do not need to split into groups of men and women. The female teaching with him split us into lines and made sure everybody was lined up, and then invited me to come forward and give the adhan, the call to prayer. Nervously, I walked up, put my hand over my ear so that I was listening to God. And as we all faced east, Allahu Akbar, meaning God is great, and then reciting the Salat. Standing in this room, a non-Muslim giving the call to prayer, men and women and transgender folks all in a line, all accepted. This was not the vision of Islam I had been taught in rural Indiana. Anybody else have that experience, not being taught a particularly inclusive way of understanding Islam? This is not the Islam of the false narrative that we hear in the news regularly. This was real, and it was every day, and it was connected to people and community. It was 2005, and in this multi-religious setting, we were breaking just about every stereotype about Islam imaginable. We were living in a narrative that countered the oppressive systems in the United States and much of the Western world about Muslim people. Some of the most vehement arguments about Islam that I have had have been from people living in Europe, where the hatred towards Islam, if you can actually imagine it, is worse than it is here in a lot of places. The word Muslim has a lot of different meanings. The way it's translated into English, it's hard to understand at times. The most common understanding is that it means those people who believe in Islam, who recite the words, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Reciting that phrase three times in Arabic is all it takes to become a Muslim. That's it. It can mean other things as well. Muslim can mean the people of the book. The people of the book are Christians, Jewish people, and Muslims. It could mean humanity in general. Muslim refers to every person sitting here today. Every single person living and breathing is another version of the word Muslim. So it has a wide array of meanings, and when you hear it spoken in culture outside of our own, know it may not mean what you think it means. At its core, this notion of multiple understandings of Muslim and of Islam is at its core a universalist understanding. Universalism itself refers to a whole sundry things. In the Christian context, all are saved and all will join the kingdom of God. But it is more than that. The theological notion of universalism is recognition of the humanity of all. It is our first principle the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And what's the kids' version of that one? Anybody know? Each person is worthwhile. That's right. We all have value. The word Muslim in one of its many meanings is just this: universalism, the connectedness and the unity of all creation. This is the core value that has connected Unitarian and Universalist people throughout history with Muslim people of the communities that we have shared. From Transylvania and Poland in the 15th and 16th centuries to Emerson in the 19th century to the collaborative work that we engage with Muslim communities today, we have discovered time and again that we have much in common. My minister in my congregation, Church of the Larger Fellowship, Meg Riley, likes to share the story of working in our United Nations office in D.C., and a group of Muslim folks visited the United Nations office and was asking what the religion was, and she was describing it, and goes, "Oh, Sufism." And they instantly knew who we were. And whenever they came back to D.C., they always wanted to see Meg and talk about how our religions had so much in common. The idea of universalism as a value in Islam is not something frequently shared in the media. Anybody heard it recently on any TV shows they've watched? It's not common. Every once in a while, Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert might get close, but they never really quite get there. The idea of universalism is not unique to us or to the West. Even before 9/11, Islam was portrayed as a religion of zealots and fundamentalists out to destroy the Western world. The reality is very different from this. The reality is so far from this portrayal that it can be hurtful and dangerous, and it actually has cost the lives of real people in the United States. And it is almost an acceptable prejudice in a lot of circles. Sorry, I think I got the wrong page, so that's why I'm like, what's going on? Okay. So I was serving a congregation in Cleveland, Ohio, and the Council on American Islamic Relations Cleveland teamed up with our church to show a documentary on the lives of everyday Muslims titled, "What a Billion Muslims Really Think." Has anybody seen that documentary? It's a good one. What a billion Muslims really think, and I really want you to think about that, a billion. Can a billion people monolithically think anything? Can the people in this room monolithically think anything, right? You know, we can't all possibly agree. So what do a billion Muslims really think? It's quite an undertaking for an hour-long documentary. Interviewing Muslims all over the world, including the United States, Iran, India, Britain, and beyond, it dared to suggest that only a fraction of a percent of Muslims are so fundamentalist in ideology that they would be out to hurt someone. And even today with ISIS, it's still a fraction of a percent. The truth being that much like us or anyone, most Muslims are more interested in putting food on the table, laughing with their kids, sharing in life and beauty, just like anyone else. In the question and answer session afterwards, there was a deep moment of tension. As a welcoming congregation, which in our denomination, welcoming congregations are those who are welcoming to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people, as is this congregation. As a welcoming congregation, the Unitarian Universalist language for being welcoming to people of varying gender identities and sexual orientations, some of the church members wanted to know about Muslim views on sexuality. The chair of the Q&A, Queer and Allies, the church's LGBTQ group, stood up and asked what most Muslims thought about LGBTQ people. Everyone on the panel said that the Quran was expressly against it and that it was against the will of God. But one of the panelists commented, "It is clearly against God's laws, but you must understand, it is not for me to say if it is all right or not. That is between a person and Allah." That is between the person and Allah. It is not considered okay within Muslim community, but we do not believe in getting between a person and God. Contrary to popular belief, Islam is a religion that trusts in the relationship between a person and Allah. They have never had a moment, like in Catholicism, where it's required to go through another agent to be able to speak to God. In fact, not even imams have the ultimate say over how a person lives with God. Sharia law may be treated as absolute in the culture of some countries, but in these cases it is enforced as a product of political and social power more than everyday religion. Does that make sense? Right? People are supposed to have a personal relationship with the Quran. And in fact, Muslims will often say you can't hit a bush without hitting two imams, you know. So we don't listen to them a lot of the time, right? It's up to the individual to have a relationship with God. Sound familiar, right? That sounds kind of like us, doesn't it? That's not an accident. Come to that. Islam's a beautiful religion. Just like all religions, there are times when fundamentalists abuse it for power and control. However, to focus on that narrative would be like focusing on only the Inquisition in the history of Christianity and forgetting that Christianity was at the core of Martin Luther King Jr.'s work. We want the whole story, not just the negative bits and not just the positive ones. Karen Armstrong writes in her book, Muhammad, when Ayatollah Khomeini issued his infamous fatwa against Rushdie, anybody remember this when this happened? He wrote the satanic verses. When he issued the fatwa against Rushdie and his publishers, the Western prejudice became even more blatant. In 1990, when I was writing this book, nobody in Britain wanted to hear, almost exactly a month after the fatwa was issued, that at a meeting of the Islamic Congress, 44 out of the 45 member states condemned the Ayatollah's ruling as un-Islamic, leaving Iran out in the cold. Very few Western people were interested to hear that the sheikhs of Saudi Arabia, the Holy Land of Islam, and the prestigious Al-Azhar Madrasa in Cairo had also declared that the fatwa contravened Islamic law. Only a handful of people seemed prepared to listen sympathetically to the many Muslims in Britain who dissociated themselves from the Ayatollah, who had no wish to see Rushdie killed, but who had felt profoundly distressed by what they regarded as the blasphemous portrait of their prophet. As far as the Western intelligentsia was concerned, Islam was inherently intolerant, fanatical faith, which deserved no respect, and the sensitivities of Muslims who felt hurt by Rushdie's portrait of their beloved prophet in the satanic verses was completely unimportant. In other words, not surprisingly, the Western intelligentsia was out of covenant, out of relationship with the people who were deeply hurt by what had been written. And that indifference continues today. But what we know is that the truth is a lot more complicated always, right? If you hear a simple answer, you can be guaranteed there's probably 5 layers of truth, if not 500. And getting to the heart of what's really going on can be difficult. The Hadith of Gabriel is one of the holy texts in Islam. And it shares the simple faith, nothing more complicated than saying that you believe in beauty, and that you're willing to follow the 5 laws. And having participated in all of the 5 except for going to Mecca, which would be an interesting day, I'm not sure how welcoming Saudi Arabia is to transgender folks, so we'd have to see. But having participated in all of those, I've found that it's deeply meaningful stuff. I encourage you to consider attending a mosque or engaging in some of the rituals, because they are beautiful in and of themselves. They're amazingly centering. Now, around the same time that the conversation on queer folk in Islam occurred at the West Shore congregation, another documentary came out called A Jihad for Love. Has anybody seen that? Jihad for Love is the story specifically of LGBTQ Muslims, and it tells the story of LGBTQ saints and prophets of Islam. For example, in Pakistan, there were 2 men who were clearly lovers, both of whom are annually celebrated by millions of Pakistanis for the wisdom and gifts they've given their community. And the same thing is in India, in Egypt, in South Africa. And there are out Muslim imams, and there are out Muslim people all over the world, and it told their stories. And what it did was talk about the difference between the Quran and Shia law. Shia law is kind of hand-picked by people, kind of like Leviticus is at times. You know, we don't like the homosexuals, so we'll use that part of Leviticus, but I'm going to eat bacon until I die, right? That stuff. Sharia law is often treated the same. And so it shows Muslims who are LGBTQ reading through Sharia law to find out what they really need to know about themselves. And just as Christian communities are having this conversation day in, day out, so are Muslim communities. So much so that now there are entire congregations dedicated just to supporting LGBTQ people. In Indonesia, there are multiple mosques that are just for trans women, transgender women who are Muslim. That's all they are. All over the world, it is changing. There's a group called Al-Fitra, which specifically works with LGBTQ Muslims to be able to connect and to be able to help Islam understand their lives and their spiritual lives. Earlier we talked about Khadija, and I really think it's important to know that the betrayal of how women are treated in Islam and the media has a whole lot of banter. It's interesting that you hear a lot about hijabs, but you hear very little about the regular violence that occurs towards women in particular countries. And in Islam, women have a lot of power of authority, and there are female imams. It's not an absolute either or. In Syria, there are Muslim women who risk their lives every day to try and create equality for women. And we've heard a lot about Syria in the news of late. You know, that there are women standing up for their rights in these countries where it's extreme, but then you go to Turkey and it's just understood that women are equal and have rights, right? So it varies from country to country. And it's important not to get lost in the clothing of it all. I got into an argument with a friend of mine from India, and the prejudice towards Islam in India is not insignificant. He was raised Hindu, and he said, well, you know, they make women do this and that. And I said, well, as soon as men are allowed to wear dresses without ridicule in the United States, then we can start commenting on hijabs, right? In other words, we got our own work to do. We have no right to be casting stones at other people. And because it's not our culture, we don't fully understand all of the issues involved. So through all of this, we have managed to rewrite history, I think is the largest point I can get to you. That in Islam, we've managed to rewrite history for this narrative. And when I say we, I'm talking about Western culture in general. You know, so for example, the fact that there was a golden age in Iraq, in Baghdad, at the same time as, you know, the medieval times in Europe. And the fact that Muslim scholars from Baghdad went into Europe and saved knowledge, written works, grabbed items that were otherwise going to be destroyed because Europe was going through such upheaval. And that during that time, most of the work that we know about biology, algebra, astronomy, physics, came out long before Europe was even at a point of getting to that magical renaissance. Islam was the very first place in the West as it took over to allow for freedom of religion, because Islam does not believe in forced conversion. You have to choose it. You cannot coerce someone to become a Muslim. And so in Spain, during Al-Andalus, and up until the late 1400s, Christians, Jews, and Muslims lived in relative peace and harmony for almost 700 years. We lose these stories because there's this narrative that fits into an us-them paradigm, and we have to really look into the stories and the truth. So I close with this. You remember I said there's a lot in common between us and Islam, Unitarian Universalists and Muslims. Emerson and Channing and all of the great people who are our forefathers and foremothers studied Islam, knew about Islam, and lifted up those values. The Sa'di reading that we heard this morning was one of Emerson's favorite works. So When you read Emerson, you're like, wow, this sounds a lot like something that I read in Rumi or I read somewhere else. That's because it was. And a lot of those universalist ideals that came out in Unitarian Universalism weren't necessarily from the universalists, but from Islam. And finally, it's actually Islam that made it possible for Unitarianism to survive in Europe at all. In Transylvania, what is now Hungary, Romania, Unitarianism was being literally burned down and brainwashed out of the people by the Catholic Church. They were so threatened by who we were and what we were doing. And the only place where Unitarianism survived was a place that was protected by the Ottoman Empire. And so we've had a long history of being in relationship with Islam, of supporting and helping each other. And it's made it possible for us to be here today. So may you enjoy the beauty of Islam. May you read lots of the great books about it. May you remember Khadija. May you know that you shouldn't believe everything you hear on TV. And that there's a lot of great gifts in all the religions of the world. May it be so. I invite you to rise as your spirits and bodies allow. We're gonna do that peace, salam, shalom thing again. I'm gonna be shouting out different cities this time. So it's gonna be imperative that you keep rolling no matter what I do. And here's what I know you're capable of it, okay? Remember, we did that song in four parts at the end of church year last year, so I know you can do it. So you just have to keep going. And it goes like this, join with me. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Please clap. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Let's pause for a second. Okay, we got about half of the folks clapping. Or is there a fear of clapping? Is there a, I refuse to clap? If you're not comfortable, I get it. But yeah, just do the best you can. It helps keep the music going, right? Okay, let's try this again. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Keep going. Peace, salam, shalom. Keep going. In Riyadh, in Los Angeles, in St. Louis, in Cairo, peace, salam, shalom. I invite you to face each other across the chandelier here. Turn towards your neighbors. This is your most holy and sacred community. It is by our hands, by our presence, that the world is made holy. For we have that small grain of seed inside us, as Rumi said. So look at the light and the seeds and the eyes and the faces of the people around you. We are here for you. Go forth this week sharing your light, your love, your wisdom, and return back to us, knowing that we will be here for you with open arms. May you go in peace. Blessed be.